offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. As always, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, here to continue this series, which I have the opportunity to do with all of you. At the very outset, sorry for the delay in the program. We started the Bhajan Tutor very late today because of some technical glitch we had. We had a problem restarting the system after the Mandir Vedam, and that's why we got delayed. So we didn't want to skip the segment, and because of that, we are starting the Gita series episode also late by almost 20 minutes or more than that. But hopefully we'll be able to maintain the same 1 hour segment, and the last segment of the day will start a little later than usual. We are still in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and we are at a point where a lot of very, very practical lessons can be learnt from the explanations that Lord Krishna is giving, and I think that is what is the most important thing about this particular work itself, because it has stood the test of time. People have time and again gone back to it to learn more about how to lead a spiritual life, or how to spiritualize one's life, for the very simple reason that the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita are something that can be directly applicable to our lives and can be practiced in everyday life. Especially this particular part we are going through is something which is very, very relatable to. The last week we covered three verses, verse number 60, 61 and 62. And as always, let's begin with a short summary of these verses that we covered last week. In verse number 60, Krishna explains that even for a person who is discriminating well and who has this ability to see right from wrong and who has a good amount of self-control on oneself, the violently stirred senses can still steal away the mind, right? That's what he says in verse number 60. He says it is a good start of controlling your senses by starving them, right? That is the phrase that he uses. You can deny the senses and you can control the senses to a certain extent, and they will also behave well when this technique is used. But since the taste or the rasa is not completely sublimated, there may come across an object or a situation that can get the senses rattled or activated, and one may lose one's mind or lose one's control in the process, right? So it is a reiteration of what was said, I think, in the previous verse, where he says that the rasa does not go away so easily. In fact, there's a very beautiful episode from the life of Swami Chidmayananda, where he says this. He talks about this interaction that he has with a youngster when he's giving a satsang, and he invites questions from the audience. There is this youngster who is probably a teenager, and very casually and bordering on the lines of disrespect, he asks Swami Chidmayananda. He says, "I believe that you're a graduate in law. I believe that you were a journalist. I believe that you were doing pretty well in whatever you're doing. Why did you leave all that and become a sannyasi?" Right? And even as this youngster was asking the revered Swamiji this question, apparently he was chewing gum, right? I mean, that's quite disrespectful, to say the least. So Swami Chidmayananda observed this youngster asking this question, and he asked a question in return. He says, "I see that you're chewing gum. When will you spit out the gum?" he asked. So this boy was wondering what is the correlation between the question that he asked and the question the Swamiji is asking. And this boy replied, when I've probably taken out all the essence out of the gum and all the juice has gone, I'll spit it out. And immediately the Swamiji said, same is the case with me. There is no more rasa in samsara for me. I have chewed it enough, so I've spit it out, right? So very, very beautiful answer, but very, very important thing that he says. We cannot completely give away all worldly desires as long as there is a little bit of that rasa, taste for the world. And it will not go away so easily. It did not go away at the end of the discourse that Arjuna received. Or definitely it is not going to go away even at the end of we completing the Gita series, because that needs a lot of effort and that needs ongoing effort, right? That's what Krishna says, that you could be completely in control of yourself. You could be somebody who's having complete control over the mind and the senses. You could be someone who is able to discriminate very clearly, but still, you always run the risk of having your mind being unsettled when the senses are drawn very strongly towards an object or a situation or an outcome that you are looking for. So the solution to this Krishna gives in the next verse, which is verse number 61, where he says that you should certainly control yourself, you should rein in your senses and have discrimination, but all this is not enough. He goes on to say, Asita matparaha, you should also be established in your focus or attachment to me. And this is a very, very important point. And we spoke of how Swami said, you know, this is like the two-pronged approach that you take. One is removing the negative, where every desire that comes, you sublimate it or you reason and break it down. That is like the weeding process. The sowing process is this of getting attached to the Lord, right? So this is also very important. So he says, with all of that austerity, you will not be able to achieve unless you have this focus on the Lord. And earlier, of course, we saw that Krishna said that you should either have focus on the inner self or on the Lord, which is both the same. And of course, later in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is going to speak about the value of the idea of being devoted to the Lord, right? And of course, I think that's a very, very long way before we get there. And as I mentioned the last time, the verse 62 is very, very closely related to 63, and they are connected in that sense. There is a sequence of occurrences is explained by Krishna in those two verses. So instead of just giving you a very superficial summary of verse number 62, I thought we will revise it a little more in detail. And from there we take it on and directly go to 63, and we'll be able to follow the flow from 62 to 63. So in this verse, Krishna speaks of what happens when the mind constantly dwells on something, some object or some event. He says, Dhyayato Vishayan Pumsaha. When a man contemplates on the objects of the senses, Sangaha, attachment, Teshu Upajayate, arises in that person. So when do we contemplate on something so much? Most often, if we analyze it, we contemplate on something because we don't know that object well, or we don't know exactly what will happen if we get that object. Let me give you a very, very silly example. There are these many, many advertisements that keep coming on TV that show that if you use a particular perfume and people will start noticing you and people start getting attracted to you, and suddenly you'll become super confident and all these kind of things, everything in your life will start falling in place. I'm sure none of us are really dumb enough to believe all that is being said. But let us say for the sake of argument, that I do believe whatever is said. So that this perfume is so good that it is going to change my life in all these ways. I will keep thinking about it, and let's say I'm not in a position to afford that particular object. So I will keep imagining that, oh my God, if only I had that thing, if only that I could get my hand on that, if only I could afford that. But the moment, let's say, I have reached a state where I can afford it, the moment I use the perfume, I'll know that it's a perfume. And that's what it does, and nothing more. It does what it is meant to do, and everything else was probably a fancy that was sold to me, and that was a fancy which was there in my mind, right? Same is the case with probably a poor man who's looking at somebody who's rich and thinks, how I wish I had that kind of money. Why? Because he's constantly bombarded by sights that keep suggesting to him that he cannot be unhappy with so much money, right? Oh, you'll have a house like this. Oh, you'll have a car like this. Oh, you know, you can go on vacations like this, and you can have fun with your children like this. All of that is centered on this idea that if only you had become a little more rich. But the person who is really rich, who has really got that kind of money, will know, yes, money does bring a little bit of comfort to your life. It can buy you a few conveniences, but it's not everything. It cannot do anything more than that. You still have to work at relationships. You still have to spend time on things that can give you that satisfaction and fulfillment, right? It is only the unknown which makes you contemplate on it. And as I mentioned the last week, things like wealth and authority, is such a object that unless we choose to learn the lesson, we will not. Merely by having more money, we will not realize that money cannot get us everything. Unless we have that discrimination going along with that, we attaining that thing, right? Because a poor man will want to become a little well off, and when he gets a little well off, he'll feel that, oh, I should become a millionaire. When he becomes a millionaire, he should feel, oh, a million is not enough, I should have a few millions. It is an endless pit. Same is the case with authority, as we discussed last week. So it is not merely that, oh, if I attain it, then I will lose my fancy for it. It does not happen always. That is why that it has to be backed by the understanding. We must consciously analyze the experience even as we are going through it. But that's, of course, a different point. The point here is, more often than not, what we do not understand becomes a fancy in our minds, right? Let's keep that point with us for now. And then we start constantly thinking about it, right? So what happens when I constantly keep thinking about it? I will start making decisions based on it. I will have it in my mind, and when I'm planning my life, it will start showing up in the decisions that I make. In other words, it will start becoming an obsession, right? If money becomes something that I'm constantly thinking about, I will all the time keep thinking of, how can I get more money? What course should I study? What profession should I take up? When I take up a profession, where should I work? What kind of a company I should work? I become a doctor, should I work in a corporate hospital? Or should I work in a government hospital? All of these decisions will be based on the obsession that I have taken on in my life, right? And that is what Krishna says, Dhyayato Vishayan Pumsaha Sangasteshu Pajayate. It will lead to attachment. And when I am attached to something, what happens next? It will start defining my actions. For example, I am attached to my family. I'll work more to keep them comfortable, right? My action will be in that direction. I'll try to control their lives. Maybe the intention may be good, but that's what I'll be trying to do. And that's why they often describe attachment as a golden cage. When I am attached to someone, I think that I am giving that person something that is as precious as gold, but that person sees it as a cage. That is what attachment does. But whatever it is, this will lead to me doing actions with a desire to maintain that attachment, right? Sangat sanjayate kamaha. From attachment arises kama or desire. That is the next clear progression that happens. If you look at it, the whole discourse of the Bhagavad Gita is about how one can go about doing actions, right? And doing actions backed with desires is the most common method. And Krishna says the most unintelligent way of doing actions too. The other is, of course, doing actions backed with Buddhir Yoga or Karma Yoga, as Krishna has been explaining. Why is it not wise to do actions purely backed by karma or desire? Of the thousands or millions of desires that we have, there are bound to be a few desires which cannot be satisfied, right? How much ever rich you are, how much ever lucky you are, however you might be born in a princely family, you will certainly encounter desires which cannot be fulfilled. That's the nature of life, right? And all these unfulfilled desires will slowly start building up our irritation, anger, and disappointment. Kamat krodha abhijayate. Kamat krodha abhijayate, he says. All of these desires, we satisfy a few of them. We are able to, you know, live with a few unsatisfied desires. But most of these desires which are unfulfilled and which we have got attached to, right? That's the most important point. There are many fleeting desires. We might look at something and say, oh, I wish I had it. Then I forget it. But those desires that are born out of attachment, right? And that is why I give the example of when we are attached to a family, we have a very, very strong desire that this is what should happen in the life of our dear ones. This is the course our children's life should take, right? Those become very strong desires, and those when are not fulfilled will lead to anger, will lead to frustration, right? And if you look at it, this happens in most of the countries and cities in the world. We build our society on the foundation of such worldly aspirations, right? The youth are constantly dreaming of living a higher standard of living, having a higher standard of living. Yes, they might be working hard in trying to achieve them, right? Most of the cities, I think, even in India, you would always say that there are youngsters. They have aspirations to grow richer in life or get better in life. And they also work hard. It's not empty dreaming, right? But say if you have a government or a regime in that particular country that is not fair. And when we say it's an unfair regime, what does it mean? That you do not get value for the effort that you put in, right? You're working so hard, but you're not able to see as much results, right? And that's the difference between a country which is doing well, where if you're not interested in working hard, you can stay where you are. But if you work hard, you're promised good returns, right? So in those countries where you have the regime which does not support that kind of equality, what happens is there will be these youngsters who have these aspirations, who are working so hard towards it, but all desires will not be fulfilled, right? And if you look at it, this eventually will lead to an outburst of anger and agitation and anarchy. And yes, some of these will lead to some kind of a revolution, right? That revolution will be born out of a violent protest and all of that. But any change that is brought about on the basis of such worldly aspirations and desires is not likely to bring about a positive, long-lasting change. On the contrary, if you see any other revolution or a struggle that has resulted in the birth of, say, a good, a great nation or a good sustained change, you will see that people always had a selfless motive and, more importantly, a selfless, duty-minded motive in their approach to that revolution. You know, look at any of the great leaders that we have come across, be it Martin Luther King, be it Abraham Lincoln, or the leaders of the Indian freedom struggle. In fact, if you were to go back to the freedom fighters in the Indian freedom movement, you will see that most of them were inspired by the Bhagavad Gita because they had that sense of duty. There was no desire which was backing it. There was no feeling that, you know, I will enjoy this power or I will attain this thing if India becomes free. It was a sense of duty. And most of them were really karma yogis in that sense. In fact, one of the greatest freedom fighters, Bal Gangadhar Tilak, whom Swami speaks of as one of the ideal leaders in his discourses to the MBA students, he has in fact written one of the finest commentaries, the finest books on the Bhagavad Gita called Gita Rahasya, right? So these are all examples that when even a revolution is backed by the sense of duty and selflessness, the kind of change that it brings about is completely different, right? Of course, this is in the societal level, but even in the individual level, this anger is extremely dangerous, right? Till this point, till verse number 62, Krishna says, how when you're constantly contemplating on sense objects, it eventually leads to anger. But verse number 63 is a description of what happens when that anger sets in. So we'll go to verse number 63, as always. I have it here rendered by Brother Shyam, one of our alumnus. We'll listen to it in his voice. I'll give you a brief meaning of that verse and then we'll discuss about it in detail.
Krodhat bhavati sammoha, sammohat smriti vibhramaha, smriti bhramshat buddhi nasho, buddhi nashat pranashyati.
From anger follows delusion. From delusion, failure of memory. From the failure of memory, the loss of understanding. From the loss of understanding, one perishes. Now we came to the point where the anger has come. The desires were not fulfilled. The desires were, there's an obstruction to your attaining of your, whatever you've placed your mind on, and the anger has come. So when someone comes in the way of me achieving my desires, krodha or anger is born, right? If you were to look at it, from our childhood, this was the only cause of anger. We want something and we don't get it. We You know, we want to play and our parents are coming and telling us to go and study. We want to keep awake and see TV. The parents come and tell us you have to go to bed, right? So we want something and somebody obstructs what I want, right? And that is where we get angry. If we look at it, even today, that is how we get angry, as somebody very beautifully says. You know, I used to get angry when I didn't get my toys when I was a kid. Only difference is today I get angry and cry for toys which are more expensive and bigger, right? That was a toy car then, but now it's a real car right now, right? So the birth of anger has always been the same. The pattern of anger has always been the same. But that anger, as we grow, becomes more and more dangerous because there is more at stake as we become adults, right? Because we are supposed to grow in maturity and this anger endangers that maturity. And when we are talking about the spiritual path, it endangers our spiritual maturity too. Why? That is what Krishna explains in this verse. He says, Krodhad bhavati sammohaha. From anger arises delusion. What is delusion? When what I see in what I see in front of me is different from what is actually there in front of me. Right? This is what we talk of even in psychology of somebody becoming delusional. They start seeing things which is not there, or they are not able to see things which is in front of them maybe. Right? So what you are seeing in front of you is not what is actually there. Nothing distorts our perception better than anger. Right? That is what Krishna is saying here. Everything before you will be colored when you're angry. Maybe I'll quickly complete the sequence that Krishna is expressing in this particular verse, because it'll be easier to explain this whole sequence of what happens once anger steps in. Right? And the other reason is this sequence of events happens much, much more faster than the sequence of events which Krishna spoke about in the previous verse, which was 62. Because as I said, what Krishna says is dhyayate vishayan pumsaha, and that becomes karma and that becomes attachment. That can even happen over lifetimes. But here what Krishna speaks about anger, it happens so very quickly. So he says, krodhat bhavati sammoha, from anger arises delusion. Sammohat smriti vibramaha, from delusion comes loss of memory. Smriti bramshad buddhinashaha. When you lose memory, you lose your discrimination. Buddhinashat pranashyati. When one loses discrimination, one is ruined. I think there can be no better description of how the mind leads us to ruin, or rather the desires in the mind lead us to ruin. It is so very beautifully and graphically and, you know, methodically explained by Lord Krishna in these two verses. Going back to the point on anger, when we get angry, we are not able to see the situation clearly, right? That is what invariably happens. When angry, we do not think and act. We react, right? That's the whole problem with this emotion of anger. We act impulsively. We speak things we probably would not have spoken otherwise. We might end up doing things we would not definitely do if we were calm, right? What does this suggest? That it means that the mechanism that makes me weigh things, pros and cons, right and wrong, is defunct in that moment when I am in the grip of anger. In other words, buddhinasha, the destruction of discrimination has happened. Buddhinasha has happened, right? That's what this means. Once the buddhi is lost, we are in the animal state. As Swami has so many times described in his discourses, what is it that differentiates the human state from an animal state? It is this intelligence, this intellect, which can take control of any situation. You are not driven by impulse. You are not driven by what is in front of you. You choose whether you want to accept it or you don't want to accept it, whether you want to pursue it, you don't want to pursue it, right? The moment you say, with anger, you lose that ability to pause and discriminate, you are going to the animal state. And there is no better downfall than that, because instead of going upward, we are going backwards, right? But how do we lose this buddhi? How does this process of getting anger lead to the loss of buddhi? When we make any decision, we always rely upon memory, right? And, of course, an eye on the consequence of what we are going to do. Let us say there is this red rock in front of me and there is smoke coming out of it. How do I discriminate that this must be probably a burning charcoal? It is from my memory of seeing something like that before, or maybe picking up something like this as a child and burning my fingers, right? Similarly, when I'm able to also see what will be the consequence of me picking up, right, from me having done it in the past. So for both of this, I need memory. It is my memory which is allowing me to make that decision of whether to do that or not, right? So that memory is very important for decision making. With time, of course, simple things like hot and cold and whether to pick up this or not pick up this, if there is a thorn, if there's something sharp, all of these becomes reflex, right? It becomes very spontaneous to us. We don't have to think about it. But the point is, memory is a very, very important tool for making decisions. When I was doing the earlier show of the Answering Booth, there was this question on living in the moment, right? The answer to that question, I had explained about how the wisdom of the past experience and the consequence of the future make the present powerful, right? Why does Swami say the present moment is so powerful? Because all the learning of the past, if it can be applied, it can be applied only now. And whatever you do now is going to define your future. And that is what makes the present powerful. But if I act in such a manner that the future is not factored into the present moment, and if I'm not thinking about the lessons of the past in the present moment, then I'm wasting the present moment, right? And when in anger, that is what happens. The best way to analyze how irrational we really become when angry is if we can look at when we become angry, say, against Swami. We know in the depth of our hearts that definitely Swami is absolutely selfless, that he loves us and cannot harm us, and also that Swami is the most just person, right? We all would have had this experience in the past where, you know, Swami has been very kind to us in our critical situations. But when we become angry, when we are upset about something and Swami has done something and Swami has allowed something to happen in our life and we are very, very upset about it, we forget all of these ideas that we have of Swami and the experiences that we have had of Swami being kind to us, and that whole memory is lost and we get angry with Swami, right, at that moment. I'm saying this with personal experience. I'm sure most of the devotees also would know this, because we all, you know, it is also an expression of our closeness to Swami when we are able to pick up a fight with Swami and we get angry with Swami, right? That's a different argument altogether. But when we get angry, if you analyze, you completely forget that you are getting angry against somebody who cannot even imagine harming you. You're getting angry with somebody who is absolutely pure in his intentions. You're getting angry with somebody who cannot do anything which is unjust. And why do we forget all that? Because, as Krishna says, when you get angry, you lose your ability to, you know, remember, right? That is how delusion happens. The reason why I was specifically telling this about with regards to anger against Swami is because it's so much easy. When you're talking about Swami, there could be other people whom you're dealing with, who may be imperfect in a sense, and you know your anger could be partially justified because that person is harming you or whatever. But when you're talking about anger against Swami, there is absolutely nothing that can justify that anger. But we do get angry because the memory is completely suppressed at that particular moment. So from contemplation of contemplation to attachment to desire to anger may be a very, very slow process. But once anger steps in, anger to delusion, delusion to memory loss to failure of discrimination happens very, very swiftly. You do not have much time to see how this happens. And that is why the control that we can exercise is enormously more before the aggression or depression or anger sets in. Anyway, we'll revisit this section shortly. So this is the sequence of events that occurs, and it all starts with the senses going astray, right? That is why Swami would repeatedly say sama and dama, mind and sense control, is the starting point of all sadhana. Swami would say this almost in every discourse where he speaks about the mind and the senses. Spirituality says, I am not the body and I am not the mind, but without sama and dama, mind and sense control, there is no way I will be able to get to the understanding that I am not this body and the mind. And probably the greatest joke or disaster is to give a free run to the senses in the name of spirituality, like some philosophies do, right? Now, continuing with what Krishna is saying here, the next few verses suggest what happens when one has control and one does not have control till the stage of anger, and then steamrolls literally into that state of being an animal. So before we move there, let us take a few minutes and look at the practical learnings that we can take from this beautiful and brilliant explanation of the science behind anger leading to indiscrimination that Krishna has spoken about. The best stage one can be in is when the rasa itself has been given up, right? That's what we had spoken of. When somebody does not even have the taste for the worldly objects, there is no way one can be distracted. The world ceases to attract one person, just like how I narrated that incident of Swami Chinmayananda, right? But that happens when one has had the direct experience of the ultimate. That's what Krishna says. Rasa varjam rasopyasya param drishtva nivartate. The senses are completely under control and the rasa itself is sublimated if one has had the vision of the Supreme. But the problem is, very, very few people are at this stage, right? When we're talking about us. And if any of us are at that stage, I don't think we need to read the Gita at all, because we are already there. We don't have to worry about anything. But the next best thing that we have not yet given up that rasa. So the next best thing is to be like the tortoise, as Krishna explained, have control over oneself, right? I can still be affected in my senses and violently be stirred. Indriyani pramathini haranti prasabham manaha. The tumultuous sense organs forcefully take away the mind. I'm still in this stage, but I can control my senses and control my mind to a certain extent. So given that I'm not a perfect sattapragna, the next best option for me is to withdraw my senses before they lead me to ruin. And if I do that, then I don't go through this entire sequence of events that Krishna has spoken about, right? How is this possible? Do whatever is done as duty. Do it without expectations and without being drawn to one set of results and being repulsed from another set of results. And do it as an offering to God. Do it with attachment to God. Tani sarvani samyamya yukta asita matparaha. Be a yukta, which means a discriminating person, control all your senses and remain focused on me, right? So this is the option Krishna is giving. If you're not a sattapragna, your rasa has not been sublimated, then how do you go about? This is the way. Before your senses lead you to ruin, control them. How do you control them? Do your duty, do it without attachment, do it without expectation, and do it as an offering to God so that you build this attachment to the Lord. So this is, in a way, countering the attachment to worldly things with a stronger attachment, that is attachment to God. In other words, the self-reflection that we are supposed to do starts before the mind is set upon anything, any sense object or any desire, right? Even before that, you do it through these processes that Krishna is saying. Now, let us say that we have not done that, right? We have not done this exercise of reining in the mind before it launches on something. We have already started fancying something. We have aspirations to, say, become rich or achieve something. So we are now at a state of dhyayato vishayan pumsaha. The mind is already in that contemplation mode. I'm already thinking about how cool my life will be if I have that luxury car. How happy I would be if I marry that person. How great my life would be if I become a doctor or whatever it is. You've already started fancying. You're already, your mind is contemplating something as being better than something else. So before sangaha upajayate, before attachment arises, I have a small window. What is it? When I'm contemplating on these fancies, which I think will probably complete my life or going to change my life completely, can we introduce an element of doubt there? Can we tell ourselves, I am thinking I will be happy if I have this, but who knows? Maybe my life will be better otherwise too, right? So your mind is already contemplating on one particular event. I want to become a doctor. I want to become this. I want to earn this much. I want to have this job. I want to work in this company. But you introduce a little bit of doubt before that dhyayate vishayan turns into sangha or attachment. That small window you use where you add to this contemplation this idea that I really want this. I think it'll be really nice if I have this. But who knows? It might be well even otherwise, right? So you are introducing that element of ambiguity in the stage of contemplation itself. Or in the case of devotees of Swami like us, I want this so badly, but I think when you say that I want this so badly, I think that I will be happy if I have this. I will be very happy if this thing happens in my life. But then we turn to Swami and say, Swami, I want this, but you know what is best. I will leave it to you. If it is good for me, you give it to me. So essentially, we are doing what I had mentioned a few weeks ago. We are reducing our hatred towards the opposite of what we want. In other words, we are reducing our dvesha. When we add this to our contemplation, what happens? My attachment to a certain outcome gradually reduces. So in general, my attachment itself reduces, right? So now this contemplation of what I don't get can be done even after we are attached to something, right? But the window that we have between before getting attached and the contemplation stage is much, much more empowering, right? So for those of us who are still about fancying about something, oh, I wish I had this, oh, I wish I could do this, it could be anything. Oh, how I wish I'd go and settle in this particular city, or how I wish I get married to this person, or whatever it is. Introduce a certain amount of doubt, either through your devotion to Swami or in a general sense that who knows, I think that this is going to make my life better, but let's see. Swami knows best, right? Just to introduce that amount of doubt into it. But at the same time, you can do this even after you're attached, right? And if you look at it, all of us are attached to something, some person or an event. So we can also do this contemplation of the contrary, but it's just that it'll be a little more difficult. You know, when you're really attached to a person, it's very difficult for you to even think of something unpleasant happening to that person. Or when you're really attached to one particular outcome, I somehow want to get this job. It is very difficult for us to pull ourselves a little back and say that, okay, even if I don't get this job, it's okay. That is why it is easier to do it before attachment. But this contemplation can be done even if one person is already attached to something or an event, right? And if we do it even in that stage, it will reduce it before it becomes a desire. Before the desire takes root, we will be able to handle it to a certain extent. If you look at it, a lot of us, you know, especially devotees of Swami are in this stage. We invariably come to Swami in the stage where we already have some kind of attachment to the family, right? There are a few desires based on these attachments. In fact, if you look at it, many devotees are drawn to Swami through these attachments. You want something to happen to, something good to happen to some of your children, or somebody in your family is not well and you want Swami to cure that person, or you overall want some kind of graceful protection against all the uncertainties of life. Why do we all turn to Swami because of this? Because we already are in a stage where we are attached. In fact, as Professor Kasturi would say, that the only reason he came to Swami was to find a good match for his daughter, right? it is this attachment which leads us to Swami. So many of us devotees who come to Swami drawn by all of these uncertainties in life or fear of uncertainties in life are in a stage where we are already having this kind of attachment, right? And these attachments have led us to desires. And when we have the desires, we have the fear of the opposite happening. So we come to Swami in this stage seeking Swami's abhaya or Swami's ability to remove that fear. But then slowly we learn that we must surrender to Swami. And as Swami has very, very beautifully explained, surrender is nothing but saying, it is just that contemplation of the idea that Swami, whatever happens to me is good for me, right? And this is precisely what Krishna has been telling here, that this contemplation can be done before you start aspiring for something, after you start aspiring for something and before it becomes an attachment, or after it becomes an attachment, before it becomes a desire, or even after it becomes a desire, this contemplation can be done. But once we are in the stage where anger or depression has set in, it becomes very, very difficult to take control. Because we are already in the stage where we have become impulsive, we have become reactive. So all that has to be done is before it comes to this state, right? But all is not lost if we have already come to the state where we are dejected and depressed and we are so upset with what's happened. Because even in that stage where the anger steps in, after the emotion fades away, we will invariably start thinking, right? That's what happens to all of us. So all this thinking process can be done even at that stage after the emotion of anger or depression or aggression has come and it has subsided. We can do all of these sensible, mature thinking even at that stage. Try to look for the anger, try to look for the root of the anger and then slowly break it down. That is the least we can do. So that way we can ensure that our anger is managed and dissipated in a mature manner, right? Otherwise we'll keep nurturing that disappointment and that will again start defining our life and the process that ensure after that lead us to further adharma or unrighteousness. This is what happens in everyday life, right? So the best, if you look at all of what we have said, this beautiful sequence of events that Krishna has explained, so the best is not to have a taste for any input the senses may present in front of us. But in the absence of that nature, we can dismantle the dangers of the impact of the senses and the mind by such reasoning at the various stages, where each stage is slightly better than the following stage. But the truth is, if we were to analyze ourselves, we are at all of these stages. It's not that I'm only in the anger stage or someone else is at just in the contemplation stage. We are in all of these stages in the sense that there are some desires which have already become a disappointment for us. There are some desires which are beginning to define our lives. There are some desires which are still a fancy in our mind. You said, yeah, if I can, we'll get it, or I'm not really particular about it, right? So we are in all of these stages, and that is why a universal practice of this contemplation, as Swami has taught and as Krishna has been explaining to Arjuna, is very, very important. That constant mananam is what will help us break down these desires and aspirations to the point where they do not lead us to that final ruin, right? Constantly asking, am I truly gaining happiness from outside? Am I getting attached to something? Or as Swami would say, constantly keep ruminating on whatever happens is good for me. So in this entire sequence is that of a person who dwells on objects and achievements of the world. It's a little gory picture that Krishna is painting for all of us, but a very, very important analysis of how not controlling our senses eventually leads us to ruin. But at least the next one, Krishna explains the opposite of that, or what happens when one does not let one's mind and senses lead one astray like this. And that is what the verse number 64 is all about. We'll listen to the verse. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss about it.
Raga dvesha vimuktaistu Vishayanindriyaischaran Atmavashyairvidheyatma Prasadamadhigachati.
but by perceiving objects with the organs that are free from attraction and repulsion and are under his own control, the self-controlled man attains serenity. So as we've been seeing, the whole process is centered around raga and dvesha. There is something I like and something I dislike. Going back to Arjuna's plight, Arjuna is a warrior. He probably likes the idea of a war, right? Because he's good at it, and invariably we kind of like something that we are good at. And here is Arjuna, he's a great warrior, he's a world-renowned warrior, and he loves war, and he's in front of a war, right? So he probably likes the idea of war. So his duty as a Kshatriya is also to be available when there is a war. So this is a sweet spot for him. He likes doing it, and it's also his duty. But where does the conflict begin? When he has to fight against his own people, Swajanam, right? When he wants to fight against his own people, now the duty starts overlapping with something that he dislikes. What is that he dislikes? He dislikes the idea of not having his teacher alive, not having his grandfather around, and he being the cause of all of these people being wiped out from the face of the earth, right? So now when what he dislikes is overlapping with his duty, that is when he becomes delusional, right? That is why Krishna is giving this entire discourse. So the stronger your attachment or the stronger your raga and dvesha are, the more contorted will be your idea of duty, your idea of what is right and wrong. And you're more likely to be depressed or given to extreme reactions, right? And that is the sequence that Krishna has explained so far. Here in this particular verse, he's saying, what happens when you manage to remove this raga and dvesha, or at least, if not completely remove, at least minimize to start with? He says, viyuktaihi. The word viyuktaihi means devoid of or disconnected from. Raga dvesha viyuktai stu. Whereas when one is free from raga and dvesha, till now whatever he was saying was completely when you are under the influence of raga and dvesha. But here he is saying raga dvesha viyuktai stu. Whereas when one is free from raga and dvesha, vishayani indriyascharan. And when the senses interact with the sense objects. As we've discussed before, as I said even in the start of today's show, there are two lifestyles on offer. One is finding your way around using your likes and dislikes. Pursue what you like, pursue what you fancy, or pursue what you crave for, and avoid what you dislike, avoid what you abhor and fear. That is one lifestyle. I think most of us, at least a good percentage of our life is defined by what we like and what we dislike and what we fear and what we are desperately seeking, right? That is one lifestyle. The other one, or the other way of going about your life, is one that is where you constantly ask, what is my duty? What should I be doing? What is right and wrong? So one form of lifestyle is completely led by raga and dvesha. The other lifestyle that is on offer is you are directed by dharma and adharma. And Krishna says the latter is called karma yoga. So to do that, one has to be in control of oneself. He says, atma vashaihi. One has to be in one's own control, right? That's the beautiful word you use. Atma vashaihi. You should be under your own control. You should not be controlled by objects outside or events outside or desires outside. You should be in control of yourself. Atma vashaihi. That is why he says, when in anger, I'm not in control. When in depression, I'm not in control. So I should make sure that I do not go so far as to that stage where I completely lose control of myself. And I have to learn ways of dealing with desire before it takes me to that point where I've lost control over myself, right? So then Krishna says the person has to be a vidheyatma, one who has subdued oneself, someone who has tamed the mind, in other words. So he uses these two words. He says Atma Vashahi, one who is in one's own control, and Vidheyatma, one who has subdued oneself. And he says such a person, Prasadam Adhigachati, he will attain Prasadam. Well, it is not that such a person will get Prasadam, because the moment we say Prasadam, the only thing that we can think of is the edible thing which is given at the end of a prayer session or something like that. But the word Prasadam in Sanskrit has a much, much more beautiful meaning. It means serenity or tranquility. So such a person, he says, Prasadam Adhigachati, he will attain that state of tranquility or serenity. We will be able to look at a situation with a very, very balanced mind, right? That's what Krishna is saying. You will be able to look at a situation with a calm and balanced mind. You will be able to look at it and say, this is the right thing, right? That is the most important thing about a calm and balanced mind. And I think each one of us have gone through situations in life where we have seen the difference. If we are dealing with a situation with an agitated mind, with an angry mind, with a sad state of mind, how we make decisions. On the contrary, if we are able to go into a situation with a very, very balanced mind, and we are able to do that, right? So Krishna says that this is how it happens. If you are having complete control over yourself, Atma Vashaihi and Vidheyatma, if you have subdued yourself before your mind goes to the state of anger, which is born out of that disappointment, the whole sequence of events is explained. And how do you stop yourself from steamrolling into that state, that each contemplation at each state that we spoke about, right? So that is why Swami would so often say that it all starts with anger, it all starts with desire, it all starts with lobha or greed, right? Because all of these begin to blind our vision. We cannot make decisions with a very, very clear vision. I'll probably play the next verse. We'll probably have a brief discussion of the next verse, and we'll start next week with this verse, just like how we did today with a detailed summary of the verse that we completed last week. Because in a sense, it is a continuation of what Krishna is saying in this particular verse. I'll play the verse for you. I'll give you a brief meaning of it, and of course, a very brief explanation of it too. And probably we'll conclude with that in this week's session.
Prasade sarva dukkhanam hanirasyopajayate prasanna cetaso hyashu buddhih paryavatishthate.
When there is serenity, there follows eradication of all his sorrows, because the wisdom of one who has a serene mind soon becomes firmly established. A very, very beautiful conclusion to this entire discourse that Krishna has been giving to Arjuna, right? He's saying that when you have that sense control, when you have that mind control, when you're able to subdue the senses, some you would often give that analogy of the senses being like snakes. So you have to know the art of snake charming, the art of controlling your senses, right? So Swami would say that Krishna is saying that once you've reached that state, you are proceeding towards the state of prasadam, prasadam pratigachati. He says you're proceeding towards that state of having that tranquility. Of course, the supreme prasadam state, if you want to look at it, is when one is in complete control, one is already liberated from all of these pulls of the senses. But even otherwise, even if we are able to have a certain streak stages of that tranquility, Krishna says what will happen when you have those, when somebody is having that state of tranquility, one will be able to make decisions clearly. And the more clearly we are able to make decisions, the more clearly we are able to choose the right over the wrong, the more clearly we are able to choose our duty over what we like to do or what we are, you know, aspiring to achieve. If our actions are being guided by dharma and adharma, as we said, the more likely that you will not be doing mistakes. Yes, they might, in the worldly level, if you look at it, you might You might be seen as somebody who has missed opportunities. You might be seen as someone who has, who's been on the wrong side of luck. All of these labels might be given to you. But the more we are able to discriminate clearly and make the right choices, as Swami would say, the ability to choose Shreyas over Prayas. Shreyas is the right thing which might not be giving you a pleasant outcome right away. Prayas is something which will give you the right outcome right away, but need not necessarily be the right thing. So it takes a lot of maturity to be able to choose Shreyas over Prayas. But every time we make the choice of Shreyas, Swami says that there will be a benefit that comes from it. So Krishna says that somebody who is in that state of tranquility, the state of tranquility itself is a blessing, but what it offers the real benefit of having a tranquil mind is the ability to make the right decision. And when one is able to make the right decision, he says, Sarva dukkhanam hanivar yo pajayate. All sorrows will be removed. And we saw that, why is sorrow being used in the plural form? Why are we saying sorrows? We spoke about the three kind of sorrows that Swami has mentioned, adibhautika, adhyatmika, and my memory fails me right now. The three kinds of sorrows which Swami says, right? So all of those sorrows will be removed is what Krishna is saying here. So a very, very beautiful three or four verses that we have gone through where Krishna says that when you do not control your mind, when you let your senses go astray and you let your mind follow the senses, what will eventually happen? But if a person is self-controlled, what difference it will make to one's life is what Krishna has explained in these few verses. So I think we'll conclude with that. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. I'll join you again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the continuation of the second chapter. We have a few more verses before we can conclude the second chapter. I thank you all for being with me week after week. Please feel free to send me your feedback if there's anything that you'd like me to change the way that the explanations are being given. You can send us your feedback through our feedback mail, listener@radiosai.org. You're free to write to me personally too. You all know my mail ID. Or now, if you wish to send us your feedback through our WhatsApp number, I think you can do that also. That's how it reaches us fastest. So stay tuned. You'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today. There's going to be a new beginning this week. So stay tuned. I hope you'll enjoy that new offering which is coming up. I'll join you all again next week. Till then, take care. Jai Sainam.
You are listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.